our handout, so I'll just go over what the talks were. Heino talked about jets and radio emission. Sergey talked about the Blanford-Zniak mechanism. Jeff, who made it here from the other Waterloo, talked about measuring the spins of black holes. Massa talked about M87 and lessons of dynamics of AGN jets. Cayenne talked about the real mass of M87 and its friends. Monica, two temperature disk. Oh, there we go. Just read that. So we decided, I guess, John and I, not to bring everybody up here again, but to just have a discussion that could just cover all the topics from this morning. I wrote down some questions that that came up during the day. John, do you have some questions or?
Not some?
Okay, so I thought I would start off a little bit and start off at the end with from Sasha. Is Sasha here? Well, that's gonna be a bad thing if the speakers don't show up. So is Thomas here? There's Thomas. So one thing that I noticed in Thomas's talk is that and those long baseline detections are, I think, very spectacular, right? I mean, I think we all agree that on the first point, seeing something on those long baselines is pretty great, because that means if you can see it on a single dish in the ALMA cluster there, that when ALMA comes online, we'll get exquisite signal-to-noise ratio. I think that's really important, just to point out technically. And hats off to the whole APEX team for making that possible. That's a real technical tour de force. But what it also says is that we can start to explore those longer baselines and look for some of the hallmarks of the strong GR signatures. So for example, if there's a ring, then you start to expect to see phase signatures too. So you start to expect to see phase signatures. Right. So if we have three baselines now, you know, APEX, Hawaii, Karma, let's say, then the question is, do we have closure phases on that baseline? That's the first question. But wait for it. There's a second question, which is, whenever I see those plots of strength, you know, flux density versus baseline, you know, one always wants to put a bounce in there, right? Because that bounce is the hallmark of a ring. And the interesting thing is that the phase on one side is positive and the phase on the other side is negative. So if you can get the right combination of closure phases, you could test that. So the first question is, are there closure phases? And the second question is, Thomas, did you try to fit a ring kind of structure to that? If Jim Moran were here, that's what he would ask. Yeah. So I'm only asking Jim Moran's question.
Well, in principle, there are closure phases in the data, which I have shown there are only trivial triangles, which means we have a comma reference, comma plus whatever SMA closure phase. So the data sets, as you know, are pretty inhomogeneous, and you have to combine high and low band and do different things on different days. So to answer your question, in the two data sets which I looked at the moment for Sagittarius A star, there is no closure phase. I know that there are two more data sets, there might be some closure phases. So at the moment, I cannot say if there is a closure triangle which rules out closure phase zero or something. That's just basically all only amplitudes at the moment.
Okay.
If we are able to combine all the data sets which were obtained during this session, there should be enough information to answer your question.
That was my question. What about Jim? What about Jim's question?
Again, what?
Did you try to fit a ring model?
No, not yet.
Yeah. I mean,
the funny thing is, if you look at, let's say, if you take Occam's razor's view, right, you want to try the simplest things first, right? And if you come up with a solution with a very simple thing, like an elliptical Gaussian, you probably don't want to go further. The data do not look as if there is a local minimum and then the visibility come up again. Of course, in principle, there is enough spacing in the UV plane to put a minimum somewhere. So one can fit a ring model, it's definitely. You will find certainly a possibility to fit a ring model. At the moment, the data are so fresh and the calibration took so long time that we have not had time to do it, but we can do it, of course.
So on that, can I just ask, you know, we've been working off of two clusters of points in the UV plane for a number of years now, very short baselines and this one long baseline. And now the measurements you showed give us one more cluster and off in a very different, you know, off in left field, right? It's not along the same line. So do you think that it's even justified to try to fit these Gaussian models at this point, unless you have other strong priors that tell you that's a model you should think about?
All these tests which have been shown so far with the triangle can be now repeated with the quadrangle. So you basically can check if the visibilities which were seen in amplitude and later also in phase are consistent with any of the models. And I think the data are sufficiently good to exclude a certain class of model and to further confirm other classes. I mean, we are basically looking not exactly perpendicular in the UV plane, sort of an inclined angle of 60 degrees. So we are basically sampling the other dimension. And if the source is sufficiently simple, that will help us to distinguish the structure. But if the source is quite complex, like probably as it is in M87, where a single point source model fit does not look very likely in view of what we know at 3 millimeter and 7 millimeter, we would just must say that we have to wait for more data. But we can, of course, try to constrain the two directions in the UV plane which we have.
And could I respond to Jim just for a moment there, is that if there were going to be nulls in the visibilities from a crescent, that happens roughly, at least at the level that I can do the analysis in my head on the fly, in the direction of this nearly orthogonal direction from the apex karma baseline, right? You have the power that everyone has aligned their models with previously is that east-west baseline. That's the long direction, and then you have two nulls perpendicular to that. And so if there's a bounce, then that should about be the direction it's in, if it's a crescent.
Well, one of the things we'll hear about, I think, on Friday are Jason Dexter's crescent models. So maybe he can take a crack at those kinds of data, see if they are discriminatory. But I think the long baseline stuff is really interesting.
But let me emphasize one thing more. I mean, the strongest detections in terms of SNR were obtained on the karma to apex baseline. If karma is going to disappear, we have really a problem.
Right, so that's actually quite an interesting issue. I'm not sure how much we want to get into that here, but there are some possibilities that we could preserve functionality at the karma site despite the fact that it's under threat. There are some scenarios that we're entertaining, including leaving one antenna up there as the rest of them migrate down to the valley floor. But certainly I think that there are some scenarios in which we could preserve roughly the sensitivity we have now, even if we only use a single dish, and that would be done by replacing the double sideband mixers on the current karma dishes with sideband separating ALMA style mixers, which remove a lot of the atmospheric noise. And then we can also increase the bandwidth, of course, to 16 gigahertz.
But it's also the baseline length and the orientation of the baseline. So, I mean, for example, apex to karma is quite long baseline, right? If you take apex to South Pole or apex to LMT, it's much shorter.
I'm sorry, I thought you were arguing for keeping karma.
Well, keeping karma and adding the others.
And getting the others.
Yes.
Right, yeah, so I'm trying to explain that there may be some ways of keeping karma, but they'll require some support from the community. So if anybody has a spare $1 million a year, now would be the time to let us know. You know, rich uncles, that kind of thing. Okay, I had a question for Sasha. I don't want this to be Shep asking a bunch of questions, but I was quite struck, Sasha, by the FR1, FR2 stuff. The immediate question that came to mind, and maybe it doesn't even factor in here, was were black hole spins taken into account there? Or did you just produce a jet of a known power agnostic about what kind of spin there is?
So there is no black hole in those simulations. Instead of a black hole, what I do is I put a neutron star, essentially, with the magnetic field stuck into it. However, the fact that there is no event horizon doesn't really change the jet dynamics, because what really matters for the jet production is the fact that the magnetic field lines are dragged around. And they could be either dragged around by the frame dragging, which is what the black hole does, or they could be dragged around by the actual attachment or the freeze in to the surface of the neutron star. The result is almost indistinguishable. If you choose the right rotation of the neutron star to match that of the black hole, you'll get jets that are very similar. What these simulations are missing, they're missing the outflow from an accretion disk because there is none in this case. And also what the simulations are missing, they're missing all of the structure inside of the Bondi radius. Basically what I did, I tried to simplify the problem as much as I could, and so I brought the ambient medium all the way down to the central object. The effects of rotation are taken into account in the simulations because the surface rotates, and so the jets do rotate. I actually haven't tried to change the rotation rate, and that could be something interesting to explore. The basic outcome of these simulations is that just the power, given the same rotation rate, given the same ambient density profile, just this magnetic field strength variation can lead to this transition. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I, following up on that, I'd like to give Sasha just a little bit of a hard time, because that's not what FR1s look like.
Should I come out into the hot seat?
No, but it's okay. I know they're only, you were making toy models, but FR1s, by definition, the bright spots are less than half the total extent of the source, and so they're plumed far away from the brightest spot. And it may be easy to do with buoyancy or something like that, but a lot of people think that the division between FR1 and FR2 is luminosity. The real division is by morphology, and you should look at Robert Lang's work for that. But I wanted to. You don't have to reply to that.
My seat is cooling down.
What?
My seat is cooling down now.
One thing I would like to bring up is that so far we've been talking about only 10% or less of the whole AGN population, and I was wondering if people have any insight into why most AGNs are completely radio quiet, the radio quiet quasars.
So is this a question to me or a question to the entire audience?
Everyone.
I can tell you what I think, and then maybe the audience can follow up on this. From my limited understanding of radio loud, radio quiet dichotomy, it seems like the cores of radio loud and radio quiet AGN appear to be quite similar, especially when the mass correction, so-called mass correction, is applied, which suggests that somehow the jets of radio quiet AGN, they just don't get to emit beyond the core where they interact with the ambient medium. So that suggests that if, of course, beaming effects are not important at the core, which I will assume for now are not, then the fact that the core emission is similar means that the jets at small distances within the Bondi radius, before they got out of the sphere of influence of the black hole, are very similar in both radio loud and radio quiet AGN. But then once they get out of the Bondi radius, then something dramatic happens in the radio quiet guys that just don't emit. So could it be possible that the ambient medium is so dense that the jets can't even propagate that far? And so they dissipate the energy at much smaller distances, such that it doesn't get out to where it becomes optically thin. So our core moves inwards. The photosphere at lower frequencies where you determine whether the jet is radio loud or radio quiet. The photosphere moves inward, and you don't see that much emission coming out.
Anyone else on
it all comes down, it seems, to the ambient medium in this interpretation then. So if the Seyfert galaxies in low luminosity AGN, they mostly have a very dense medium, it seems like there are observations, which I would like to see if there is an expert in this. It seems like, I heard, in Seyfert galaxies, oftentimes the jets are completely misaligned with respect to the galaxy. So sometimes the jets are just going off sideways and disappearing. So it's possible that this misalignment effects cause the jets to experience much higher density in most of the time in such Seyfert galaxies. Maybe Marta has ideas if she's around. If these galaxies accrete by accretion that's mostly random in angular momentum orientation, then the black hole spin will be oriented randomly, and the accretion will be also oriented randomly, which will correspond to the jet shooting in sorts of random directions, and therefore it won't be able to propagate far enough to actually be able to radiate all that radiation if you need propagation to large scales to be able to radiate.
Did anyone else hear that? Jeff said that. But we didn't make a big deal out of that. I think that's kind of a big deal. Right? I mean, were those mostly in the X-ray binaries? Or was that I forget whether the classification was in the X-ray binaries or the supermassive black hole. X-ray binaries. So is that rare? Would we expect to see that in a supermassive black hole configuration? I mean, there, right? I mean, there's some papers, I've read them. They say you get the most power out from a retrograde dip.
There are such
papers, right? They will go unnamed, right? But I think that's important because the ISCO changes so dramatically for retrograde dips. So if there's something that's observable there, that would be kind of interesting to see. Does anybody have any feelings about whether we expect to see any of that in, let's say, SEN-A or other kinds of EHT targets? I remind people that even though we talk about Sagittarius and M87, and they're the ones we want to be trapped on a desert island with, if we had to be trapped on a desert island with two, there are some other sources. There's M31, SEN-A, most famously, coming to rain in ALMA. So there's some other sources that we could look at that are in different parameter regimes.
Can I ask a simpler first step in that question? And that is...
That was pretty simple.
So. Well, I'm sorry. I have my limitations. Is for people who've been looking at misaligned disks, are retrograde disks stable? What are the conditions for instabilities to appear that will render these qualitatively different than the kind of prograde disks that we're used to looking at?
So Sasha could answer this too, but he's talked a lot, so I'll give him a break. So he and I have done cases where we look at retrograde and prograde disks. Basically, the story is that if it's a Riaf very thick, then you can't tell the difference between prograde and retrograde.
Right.
If it's getting thinner, for whatever reason, the cooling is efficient, then it gets easier and easier to tell whether it's prograde or retrograde. And it's extreme in the case where if you have a magnetically dominated, magnetically arrested disk, and the disk is quite thick, then even near the black hole, the entire disk will co-rotate with the black hole spin direction. So not only the jet doesn't care about the direction of the spin, but even the disk near the black hole won't care about the direction of the spin. I don't know how efficient the cooling can be, which if it was efficient somewhat, then it would change that. That way you would start to detect the effects of the ISCO.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other aspect of that is that, and this is something that Avery, I think, pointed out, or he's pointed out to me, if not in his talk, that we have many epochs of M87 now. And if there is some instability in this, what's that?
Sagittarius.
Oh, it was Sagittarius. Well, but I'm thinking about M87 right now because we see many dynamical timescales in one night for Sagittarius. But for M87, we tend to think that we'll see a fairly static image every night that we observe. So we can have full Earth aperture synthesis to make a nice image. But you might see something change over a week, or you might see something change. I think Kazim talked about this over 2 weeks. And if you had some instability in the disk, if you had some turbulence, are there things that we would expect to see
over these timescales? Or more pertinently, are there things we can rule out? If we see the exact same image every single day for a week, then does that rule out a tilted disk? At what level? Does it rule out a retrograde disk? Does it rule out some kind of instability that we would expect to see on Schwarzschild radius scales?
I guess if the polarization was flipping, if you had polarization, it was flipping a lot in a secular way from one sign to the other, then maybe you could rule out the field being uniform and constant. On the other hand, if it was stable, then you could rule out that it was flipping. So maybe there are ways to constrain the magnetic field geometry and how it overall is behaving. Somebody else has some ideas.
So maybe a year ago, Craig Walker showed an image, I think it was 43 gigahertz, of M87 in two epochs. And it seemed like the jet shifted sideways. I think it was in the eastern direction by maybe one third of its radius. And so this suggests that the jet is either breathing or moving around sideways. And I'm here very biased, but that's exactly what we see in the MAD simulations. The jet is dancing around. You've seen this in the movies of John and the movie that I just showed earlier. It's very dynamic. And we expect this to happen on time scales of about 1,000 light crossing times of the black hole horizon. So one light crossing time of M87 is about 10 hours or something like this?
It's about 10 hours.
10 hours. So let's say it's one day. So we expect it of order of a couple of years. And that's exactly the difference between the two epochs of observations, I think, that Craig did. So it could be telling us something.
May I comment on that?
First, no.
I think we have to be careful with saying the jet is dancing around. Certainly, there are structural changes on these timescales, but the characteristic timescale for M87 for the ISCO is of the order of 10-15 days or so. And there's variability at the SMA observed exactly on that timescale. So there's a quasi-periodic variation sometimes, which is not confirmed, but it looks like as on a 14-day timescale, there's flux density variability, which could come from the ISCO. But I would not expect to see this in Craig's maps, because the time sampling of those maps isn't that dense. More likely, I think we see beating in the jet, but bright features coming and going, and that basically gives you the illusion that the jet is dancing around, but it's just filaments which propagate as patterns through a broader channel, and you derive a certain direction or position angle basically only on the fact that you connect by eye bright spots. If you would have a very high dynamic range image, let's say a factor of 10 or 100 better dynamic range, you would probably see that these bright spots belong to underlying patterns which somehow move, and I'm pretty much concerned whether these patterns are just patterns and not even reflect physical motion, but it's more like a Christmas tree effect.
A little bit further out with the Mojave sample, it's now well established that the position angle fluctuates back and forth within a cone.
But if you stack these images, all these position angles form more or less a common envelope in which the whole jet then propagates.
So one thing that we have done with Sagittarius Star is leverage the many, many epochs. And you know, you can imagine fitting some model, potentially wrong model, each individual day, and ask how do the orientation of that model change. And we find, except for aliasing of the 1 year observing cadence, so moving out of the same month every year would be great for this, we find that most, essentially all periods are strongly excluded in that case. And I imagine that when we have substantial time baselines with M87, we'll be doing exactly the same thing, not looking at what's happening quite far down the jet, but looking at the orientation of the jet nozzle region. And then if there is some precession of the jet driven by a potentially misaligned disk, if it's periodic, that's something that we could very, very easily pull out of that. If it's completely stochastic, then I think it gets much more complicated.
So this kind of segues into a question that I have for Kazu. Is Kazu here? Kazu, there you are, and Mareke. So I was blown away a bit by the last, one of the last slides you showed, the compressive sensing technique, right? Because what you seem to say is that even if Kion's mass estimate is not right, if it's a smaller mass, you could easily see the shadow for M87. Did I get that wrong, or is that right? Is that right? I was just not.
In that simulation, we are assuming a small mass, like 3 × 10⁹ small mass. But still, we didn't include spin, so we didn't include spin. I mean, just it's a Schwarzschild black hole. So if it's in extreme carcass, it could be smaller.
But the spin doesn't change the overall shadow
right, yes.
Much, right?
Yeah.
Maybe the 10% level.
So, well, I can safely say that, yes.
The question I had was, sampled it with an EHG array and added some kind of noise, right? And then you tried to image it with the technique, right? So have you tried to do that with real data? I mean, have you tried to super resolve using that technique on, let's say, VLDA 3mm data?
Well, yes, Kaz showed some sort of super resolution M87 data. That's coming from VLDA at 43 gigahertz. Yeah, it's just preliminary, but my feeling is it's working quite nicely. So, yeah, well, of course we have to check, but I think it's quite promising.
Yeah, I think it's very promising stuff, but we're going to need that to start to make images from the first data set. Have you also tried to use that technique on very sparse data sets? I mean, what was the sparsest data set you would try? You tried to say 3 baselines. I mean, where does it break down?
I never tested with such a sparse UV, but maybe for 3 baseline rates, it's quite difficult. It's under something, it's very significant, and it's not really easy to get images.
Right. Yeah. Force is strong with that one.
Yeah.
I was very much amazed and excited by the counterjet, which we also see at 3mm, but apparently the 7mm image of the counterjet, the one with the GBT data, the very new one, does show an X-shaped structure on the counterjet side. And if you look in the papers and the literature, there's a statement that in a lensed case, the counterjet has a different shape than the jet, so you can, in principle, distinguish between the metric and look at the shadow of the black hole by comparing the shape of the jet versus the shape of the counterjet. The counterjet is actually much broader. I think if we really are able to see the counterjet in a certain degree of clarity, we can use this to further constrain the image size, the metric, this diameter of the black hole. The shape of the counterjet is due to relativistic aberration, completely different than the shape of the jet.
So are you talking about on scales probed by M87?
Well, I'm
about on EHG scales?
Well, M87 at 7mm is I think already 10 Schwarzschild radii or 20 or something like that.
So doesn't that tell us? So I think it's a little bit bigger than that. But doesn't that tell us then about jet acceleration? If it's really relativistic aberration, that's telling us about how fast the jet's moving or accelerating the Heyer-Lorentz factor, right?
Yeah.
So in principle, what you could do is you could, if you knew exactly where the black hole was, you could take the flux ratios at each position going off, and modulo a little bit of projection unfolding, you could actually read off what the Lorentz factor was as a function of height.
Yep.
Just to pick up on that, I absolutely agree with what Avery just said. We have the code to do that. It's what we've used effectively for modeling FR1 jets on much larger scales. I think that what Thomas is talking about is actually on significantly smaller scales than the counterjet that we were looking at in any of the pictures that we saw this morning. So I think we're dealing with special relativity on the scales that we can see at the moment. And I think certainly the jet to counterjet ratio, and ideally the polarization as well, if we could get that in both the main and counterjets, could tell us a lot about the velocity field.
Well, let me just say that we saw the counterjet in a lot of those images today. It's the thing that the horizon was shadowing against. It doesn't look like a jet. It's this dimmer, amorphous blob that backlights the black hole.
So is Hara-san here? Hara-san. So can you tell us a little bit more about that counterjet? It's very important for interpreting the rest of M87. So how does the brightness profile look compared to the jet? Can you read off the inclination angle now in a much better way? Can you set limits on the speed and acceleration of the jet from that image?
Oh, excuse me, could you use a microphone? So,
I'm sorry, I thought. Hello?
Hello? Hello?
I think the background of the podium.
It says it's on. Actually, this is already. Can you hear me? So, based on that counterjet image,
yes.
Can you look at the profile of brightness as a function of distance from the core? Can you tell us, you know, if there is a much better angle of inclination derived from that now, or if there's a speed of the jet profile that's much more secure now?
Actually, in terms of counterjet issue, I'm also working on something in terms of the jet width of the counterjet and also the kinematics. In terms of kinematics, the Craig Walker group, they already measured some proper motion. So I'm not completely sure that is true or not, but they actually did, they seem to detect the motion, outward motion from the core. Then that.
On the counterjet?
Yes, in the counterjet. Then also in Mojave, by using the 15 gigahertz VLBA data, so, which is also the nicely frequently sampled, but every three or a few months time scale, they also detected some the consistent motion, which where the counterside component is moving outward from the core. So
at what speed?
It's quite subrelativistic, which is not, that speed is not completely consistent with the approaching jet motion, but it is something similar, 0.1c or something around that. Then, but of course, we should keep in mind that, as you know, the counterjet brightness is really, really diffuse. So we should keep in mind when we talk about, when we measure the motion of the counterjet. And also, this is quite very, very preliminary, but I'm now also working on the counterjet width measurement by using high dynamic range image. Then I seem to detect some the asymmetric with structure in terms of the distance from the core between the counterjet side and the approaching jet side. Then one interesting thing is that in the counterjet side, the jet width seems to be larger than that in the approaching jet side. So that could tell us something about the relativistic effect of something. So, but yes, that analysis is still really, really preliminary. So,
can I ask in relation to that really quick? When you say 0.1c, is that the apparent velocity or is that the inferred
apparent
velocity?
Apparent velocity.
Okay, so it's not that low then, right?
Sorry?
It's not really that low because it's going away from us, so it's going to be quite a bit, it's going to look a lot slower.
Yeah.
The other thing about the width, we heard a lot about, I think yesterday and a bit today, about the potential for different components of the jet lighting up. So I know in the models I showed, the assertion was always that we're lighting up the fast parts of the jet. There's certainly a lot of talk about particle acceleration and lighting up in the jet wind interface. And that could be much slower. And of course, if you're looking for the counterjet, relativistic aberration is going to make the slowest stuff look the brightest. And so I wonder if what we're learning about is really the structure of the jet wind interface. I'm just curious if people who simulate this, would that be a way to go after that? Or do you think that that's totally wrong?
I do have a question for you about the shadow, because what I was just thinking in the context of the mass is that if you do see a shadow for M87, that tells you the mass to within the modulus, the distance modulus, right? So you know basically what the mass is right away if you can see a convincing shadow. But you see a convincing shadow, and I think this is what you're getting at, only when you have something that backlights it, right? So you need, as Harasan said, a slow-moving jet that hasn't accelerated yet, that's not Doppler-boosted away from you, in order to see that shadow. So I don't know the answer to this. You probably do. What is the fastest the counterjet could be going and still backlight that black hole to give us a ring?
Well, the answer to that is, what dynamic range are we going to have? I show pictures in linear, well, there were a few different color scales, but many of the pictures I show, at least most recently, especially the ones of the models that were fitting, are all in linear. They're shown a linear intensity range. And you can see the shadow in the linear intensity range. So if you tell me we have a dynamic range of 100 to 1, we could probably find it in any one of them. Mm-hmm. And that's assuming all the emission that we're seeing is really coming from the fast component. And I've completely set aside the slow component, because that's not even modeled in the cartoon models I use.
Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting line of inquiry to find out what's going to light up that ring. Mm-hmm.
May I come back to respond to Hadassan's width of the counterjet? I mean, this is a very typical thing. The counterjet in Cygnus A, for example, is also wider than the jet. And that has been observed also in a number of other cases. If the source is inclined at a small angle to the line of sight, and 10, 20 degrees, like M87, is still a small angle, then of course you suffer from differential Doppler boosting. The faster spine points towards you and makes the jet appear much more narrow than the jet which points away from you. So the fact that you see a broader counterjet means that you have velocity stratification. And if you then get the speeds in Cygnus A, for example, also you also find that the distribution of the approaching and the receding speed is not consistent with this simple picture of having a jet which ejects symmetrically. You cannot find a solution which matches the Doppler factor, the speed, and the viewing angle. You always find speeds which are inconsistent with that. Usually they are a little bit too high. And that means you're looking at a stratified flow. And therefore, we think that the width of the counterjet and the width of the jet basically measure the differential Doppler boosting.
Question for Avery. So in the picture that somebody showed for your model that you had the bright, fast, aligned jet coming towards you. And you said that, well, if you have a dynamic range of 1 to 100, you'd be able to see your shadow. Is it sort of the total integrated light that you're comparing, the total integrated light from the fast, aligned jet coming towards you compared to the integrated light from the little ring? Or is it somehow the per pixel dynamic range?
Per pixel, it's brightness. So you can see it. You can see it with your eyes on the screen if you look for it, and you know you don't really have that kind of dynamic range in a linear plot. So that'll pop right out.
So I guess what I'm wondering is, apart from the dynamic range, if you don't resolve everything, so all that ring light should be blurred out into a larger space, and the effect of brightness should be much reduced, right?
So in this case, I don't think that the shadow isn't surrounded necessarily by a very bright, very thin ring. The shadow cuts out emission, and it's surrounded by a large plateau. The size of the plateau depends upon how slow the stuff is on the other side and what its spatial extent is and all of that. But it's a large plateau, so even if you blur that a bit, I don't think that we're really going to be able to, we're going to lose that. But this is a quantitative question, and it deserves a quantitative answer. What we would have to do is produce synthetic data, reconstruct it, and see what we can do. And we've done that. So there's the paper that Roussin had led that was tested, you know, comparing different reconstruction algorithms, but with real noise. And we can go take a look at that and see when could you see the jet. And I think in almost every situation, when could you see the shadow? And I think in almost every situation you could see the shadow if you looked for it, if you were, you know, paying attention, unless you loaded the jet really far away, you know, 30 gravitational radii or something. And so as long as the jets are lighting up below that, even in this limited class of models, then I think we'll be able to see it.
Anything else on that topic?
I have one completely unrelated question.
We love those.
Or is there an immediate response to that? Then I don't want to.
I think I might be wrong there.
Is there somebody else?
Oh, I want to ask some comment on the effect of counter jet. So actually, in my poster, I studied the effect of the counter jet, and I used a GRMHD semi-analytical model to distinguish the contribution of the forward jet and counter jet. So one interesting thing is, if we focus on the shadow resulting in from the counter jet, the shadow size is a little bit different from the shadow resulting in from the forward jet. The reason is, if we use counter jet as the background light source, it would be related to the size of the counter jet. I mean, the emitting region of the counter jet. So,
are you saying that the size of the shadow depends on what's illuminating it?
Yes. So
how can that? I'm just asking. How can that be?
Let me put it this way. If we consider forward jet, so the original, the background light is provided by the forward jet. So the resulting shadow size is, I would say, precise as we predict for the shadow size of the our usual prediction. However, if we put some background light source with some limited emitted region, in that case, the shadow size will relate to the emitted region we input. So there could be some minor difference. For example, if we focus on, if we consider the counter jet and the emitted region is restricted within some middle latitude of the black hole horizon latitude. In that case, the resulting shadow size will not precisely coincide with the shadow size resulting from the forward jet.
Okay, I guess I'm trying to understand how you get a shadow from the forward jet.
Yeah, maybe we can discuss more by the poster. Okay.
Avery, when are we done with this session? I just want to give a bit. No, but when is the dinner thing?
Getting hungry, yeah?
The dinner is at 6.
We are done at 6.
Oh. Wait, I just honestly don't know when we're supposed to. Okay, but when is the dinner thing? What? Oh, okay. Well, I had one last question. Who wants to make an announcement? Thomas, go ahead.
I have one more question to Sasha. He talked about the stagnation surface. You could explain a little bit why the stagnation surface in M87 has a finite size, while in Sagittarius itself it should be zero. That's something which I did not get from the talk. So basically you say the possible difference between having a jet or not a jet is from depending on the width of the stagnation surface. And you gave a number of 10 to the minus 5 RG for M87 and said that it's zero for Sagittarius. Can you comment what that means? I mean,
yeah, so the physical size of the stagnation surface is slightly larger, maybe by an order of magnitude, in Sagittarius A star, but the horizon radius is 1,000 times smaller. So that means that relative to the horizon radius, the size of the stagnation surface in Sagittarius A star becomes huge. Do you see what I'm saying? The mass ratio of M87 black hole.
Okay, but it's a differential width is should be the same. That means if it's 10 to the minus 5 in M87, then it's probably 10 to the minus 8 or so in Sagittarius star.
They're physical scales. The width of the stagnation surface is the region over which the gap is open. And it gets closed over a scale that's comparable to the mean free path of inverse confidence scattering or gamma-gamma annihilation. And so that sets physical scale, and you've got to compare that to the physical scale set by the size of the black hole, and you have to bring in what the illuminating soft proton background is and all of that. And for Sagittarius star, once you've done all that, you get a number that's larger than the gravitational radius, or larger than the typical scale. And so you can only have ever one generation, yet at most. And in M87, it's much smaller. So you can have many generations.
So there are two effects. One effect is that the black hole is much smaller, so the relative size of the stagnation of the gap is larger, but also the luminosity is much lower in Sagittarius A star, which gives you another order of magnitude, effectively. So these are the two.
Are you implicitly saying that sources with which are having a finite stagnation surface produce jets, and the other one not? So is this perhaps the fundamental difference why you have jets in some sources and others not? Are you going that far?
The jets are probably there in all cases. It's whether they are lit up by this mechanism or not could potentially explain why we sometimes see them, sometimes not. But that will only work for low luminosity AGN. At high luminosity AGN, there are other mechanisms to mass load the jets that will overtake the stagnation surface might not be there anymore.
Okay, thanks.
Well, John has one question or comment. Retort.
Avery and Sasha on that. So I guess the model assumes that there's no magnetic Rayleigh-Taylor or magnetic Kelvin-Helmholtz that would allow for wind or disk material to leak into the jet. That seems like probably should be happening. We can test it in our simulations, of course, but if that's at all efficient, or not even has to be not too efficient, then that should be overwhelming, I think, the densities that you're approaching for the paraloading. Is that right? Say if 1% of the mass that's accreted into the black hole goes into the funnel through these instabilities, then wouldn't that be overwhelming the densities from this mechanism?
So I don't have off the top of my head what 1% of the wind mass loading would be. What I would normalize this to is that if this mechanism works, the density at the top of the gap, the density that's within the region that's driving the process, is about, as Sasha said, about 1/1000th of the density you need to explain the emission. That comes from this post-grap cascade that Sasha demonstrated very nicely for us. So if you think that the density you're going to get off the disk is more than 1/1000th of what you need to produce the observed emission, something like 10-ish particles per cubic centimeter in M87 in the jet, then you could, in principle, shut down the gap. You'll screen it all the time. That's certainly true. Now the question is, if there's a point in the jet which is protected, which does evacuate, then you'll have this process happening. And importantly, it's not enough to put particles in the jet. You have to put relativistic particles. You've got to do two things. You've got to get something in there, and it has to be relativistic, so it's going to emit synchrotron emission.
You mean it has to be like a reconnection or something to generate a power law of non-thermal particles?
Something has to produce relativistic leptons of some variety. So putting wind particles in the jet may not ever be sufficient to produce the emission. There'd have to be some energization later on.
Okay. If there are no other comments, I do want to make. I want to thank the runners. Right. Thank you so much. There are Roman Gold, Alejandro Cardenas Avendano. Did I get that right? And Nestor Ortiz. So thanks to all the runners, and also thanks to all the.